We have a very active pre-council meeting. Out of respect for those who will be showing up at 7 o'clock for the main council meeting, I'd like to try to stay on a fairly tight timeline, and I would like to see the historic preservation presentation to allow us some interaction, questions and answers in it. So if you can limit your presentation to 20 minutes, and I'll say the same for the greenhouse gas emissions inventory presentation. So, Mr. Mathis, do you have people you want to introduce?
I believe Rachel will introduce our team on Brent. Okay. Please come forward, and we'll just dive right in. This is the economic impact of historic preservation.
I'm Brent Gardner, Vice Chair of HPC. I'd like to provide a quick background summary of the study that's been done, the economic impact of historic preservation in Columbia. Also, greetings, sorry. Development Strategies is the group that's put this together. HP has long known that historic preservation is good for the economy and that the greenest building is one that is already built, but the extent to which historic preservation affects tax revenues, vacancy rates, property values, and creates jobs was not well defined. Thus, about 2 years ago, the Commission began a journey to develop this study, which we think is the first ever local economic impact study in the state of Missouri, and is the first such study to be developed in the nation for a community of Columbia size. Let's see, move down here. I'd like to mention this, that the support of the council over the last couple of years has been extremely important to getting this project off the ground, and you've been involved from the beginning of this project. So we would like to thank the council for your support. Finally, please keep in mind this is a draft of the final report. If you have any comments in the draft, please let us know or the consultant team know. And based on those suggestions, the final report will be delivered to the public at the end of this month. And now, at this point, I'd like to introduce the consultant team. The quality of their work has more than exceeded our expectations, and we're pleased with what they've discovered. Development Strategies is a real estate, community, and economic development consulting firm based in St. Louis. They've won numerous awards for their community, land use, corridor, and economic feasibility plans. In addition, as part of the H3 Studio consulting team, Development Strategies provided the economic analysis for the downtown charrette that was commissioned by DLC 2 years ago. So presenting tonight, we have Kyle Zaylor, a real estate analyst, and Robert Lewis, who's the principal. Thanks.
Brent? I'm Bob Lewis. Kyle's not going to say anything unless there's something I don't know, and that's half the stuff. We'll move pretty quickly through this. For a while there, I thought Brent was going to steal my show and tell the whole story. Then he said, but we didn't have it all nailed down. That's pretty good. Let's roll to the right off the bat. And by the way, thank you for having us. We've really enjoyed this. This is fun. I'm not sure it's the first economic impact study in Missouri for at the local level, but because I don't know if we've researched that. But if it is, you set a great example because there's a lot of stuff in here. And I would be looking at this report not just at the numbers and how wonderful everything is, but looking at it as an opportunities to find ways to continue to invest and reinvest in historic preservation and related heritage tourism and so forth, and downtown in particular, because there's a lot of value in it, and you've already heard some of that going on. So some quick numbers. I hope anybody can see that up there, but that are in the report here, and I'm going to do this so that I can see the numbers a little better. $72 million private money spent in Columbia on historic preservation because of tax credits alone. We separated this report, I hope you know, into three parts: the historic tax credits, buildings, heritage tourism, and looking at the downtown as kind of a main street. And out of that, we get total annual input. Out of the heritage tourism, get about almost $9 million in annual output. That's economic, like GDP here in the city, and lots of jobs created, and a huge revenue increases coming out of the downtown in particular. We've got harder numbers on that as we go. And then looking at the numbers that actually came out of the Missouri study, very similar study. This report was based on the Missouri study of a few years ago out of Rutgers University, finding that for every $1 million spent, we actually, this graph tells you, don't spend that money on highways, don't spend that money on new buildings. It says spend that money on historic preservation. and rehab and use those buildings because you get more bang for your buck of the investment dollars, it turns out. That's a Missouri study. We didn't quite duplicate that here in the city, but you can see that it's pretty close. The process we followed, a bit of an agenda, but it's also really what we did was, again, we broke up the study into the economic impact from construction and rehab. We focused that on the properties here in the city who have used historic preservation tax credits, the state and federal programs. They're great data. There's no reason to use that, and you get a real good picture of what's going on. And then also on cultural heritage programs and events in the city, I would say there's not enough of those yet, but they do have a pretty strong impact. People coming in, understanding the city, and spending money while they're here and enjoying that. And then looking at downtown Columbia as an example of Main Street, where people want to be anymore, active, historic, not necessarily entirely historic, but a lot of historic. And then there's the sustainability question, some things we just touched on, Brent just touched on, we'll touch on that here in a minute. And then Q&A, hopefully we'll get done here within that 20-minute time frame. Very quick, the bulk of what we did looked at, we got data on how much money is spent for these various things. Investment in rehab, spending by visitors when they come to town to enjoy cultural heritage activities, the things going on in the various buildings. When you spend money, it has a ripple effect. And we came up with multipliers for the city of Columbia itself and ran them through so you get a total economic impact. It's not just that direct dollar or that direct investment. It's what happens beyond that, what occupies those buildings, where are the materials bought, where are the jobs created, the architects, the contractors, and so forth, and where are they spending their money. So that leads to the multiplier effects, which on the left here shows all those direct effects. Direct effects create jobs. There are operating expenses. There are capital expenses or taxes paid. As those things are paid into the community, there's a ripple effect throughout, and it creates jobs throughout. A lot of that money leaks out, so it goes into other communities. As we spend money in other places. So there's a finite number you can come up with for various multipliers. We use a number of multipliers, by the way, for different economic sectors that are involved with and directly related to the historic preservation. Too much to get into in our 20 minutes. this number here, the $4.40, focuses on the historic tax credit investments that have been made. We'll talk a little more detail here in a second about that. But suffice it to say that for every $4.40, pardon me, for that out of the amount of private money, not the public money, which is the $4.40 or tax credits per project, I'm going to screw this all up. Let's look at the blue bar. That's the first place, best place. I was trying to summarize it. $88.8 million was spent on 26 historic projects in Columbia over the last 10 years to renovate and rehab them using the Historic Preservation Tax Credit Program. That $88 million, out of that $16.4 million, the far right number, is how much was developed into or used as historic tax credits. That leverages that 16.4 then is that $4.40, four times that amount becomes the total investment or the total private investment. So there's a lot of leverage going on here. So the tax credit program, which is a state program, of course, doesn't necessarily affect the tax base of Columbia, but it's a very useful and has been throughout the state, by the way, leveraging and improving up the properties that we have here in the state and clearly here in the city. As I said, that number is based on 26 historic rehab projects here in the city of Columbia. You have 144 buildings classified now as historic buildings. Not all of them necessarily would qualify for historic tax credits given the rules on that. And I'd say, but that's a lot of them will, and you've only done 26. A lot more, and there's probably a lot more than 144 out there that could become part of and defined within the program or potential of the program. So there's a lot of opportunity for growth and improvement and, again, that reinvestment in historic preservations. It's only been 10 years since all this has gone on. The number of the bar graph points out what's been going on over those 10 years in terms of the amounts of money spent in those 26 projects. Clearly, it struggled in the beginning as things got started, exploded when the economy was still good, and slowed down. Well, don't worry about the slowdown. You still have a lot of projects. The economy's coming back, and certainly the economy of Columbia is fairly strong. So there's a lot that can be done, and based on what you've already gotten done, it's a terrific track record. This map, let's see, I guess it is. It shows most of those sites, those 26 sites, in the downtown area. Basically, Broadway goes left to right here. Most of the projects that have been done are in the downtown area. Most of the projects that qualify tend to have to be income-producing, so they tend to be commercial kinds of buildings. So they're going to focus in the old part of town. And the circles here, they're scaled to the size of the investments made in there, but they're clustered right in there. Remember that map when we get back to the downtown analysis. And then this graph here, the table you see here, you see throughout that format, you see throughout the report. I won't make you understand the table now, but essentially it takes the direct numbers at the top, multiplies them by the various multipliers in the middle, and comes up with the numbers that are shown highlighted on the side there. So because of those 26 projects over the last 10 years, there's been $200 million in output GDP, economic activity here in the city alone. The impact throughout Boone County would be a little bit bigger, if you include Columbia and Boone County, and throughout the state even a little bigger than that, because the ripple effects are stronger in larger geographies. Of that amount, $73 million has become earnings for Columbia households. And then there are 112 direct jobs created to do all of that. And then the ripple effects actually created another 800 or so jobs on top of that. So 947 jobs as a result of the investment in just the tax credit program, the buildings alone. Now, that said, this chart is the pie graph here shows the expenditures in investments in the best data we could possibly get for all historic buildings in the city. Most of those are in the universities, most of those at Mizzou. So you can see the large pie graph there says there's a lot of money being invested in historic properties at the various campuses here in town. A marvelous legacy and something to sell, as if Mizzou isn't something to sell, or Columbia or Stevens anyway. The historic side of them and what they're doing to preserve their old buildings and reuse them for updated purposes, very, very important. The tax credit projects of 26 we just talked about is just about a quarter, less than a quarter there. You see the part there. But there's enough data out that there's also been private investment in historic buildings, as well as municipal, that's not covered under the tax credit programs. The city does its own programs as well. So there's a lot going on above and beyond just the 26. The data there, we try to get as well as we could to get comparable, although the best data really are on the historic tax credit programs. Mizzou and Columbia and Stevens, by the way, were just outstanding in providing us information for this. They worked very hard to get some comparable data so we could measure apples to apples. Here again is that same kind of chart format. And this is for the construction citywide related to that pie chart above. Again, lots of money that becomes the multipliers of direct spending, earnings, and then overall about 5,000 jobs created over this period of time here in the city. Switching then to away from the investment in the buildings directly, but to heritage tourism, which was a component of the study that was done by Rutgers for the state a number of years ago and was the model for what we did here. Heritage tourism, this is the Missouri numbers. It's big. We get people to come to the state. They spend new money. They spend time in hotels and restaurants. They leave behind the ripple effects of the economy. They take away from them, of course, great impressions of Missouri and take it home, and then people come back next, or word of mouth brings people the next year. Columbia's component of that. Frankly, I wish it was bigger, given the scale of what Columbia is, and there's probably a lot of growth potential, given the power of heritage tourism with edutainment kinds of vacations we take and so forth. But we focused on four that arose here in the city that are really the key sort of heritage tourism things going on right now, including the Columbia Heritage Festival and museums and so forth. So we got the data from them on what's going on within them, and then again ran that same table, the same format. So we got at the top the kinds of money that's being spent by them to run their facility, cultural heritage activities and so forth. But also note in column three over there, visitor spending. We said, how many visitors are you getting? We've asked them. They told us. Isolate those by local and non-local, deal with the non-local because they're bringing new money in, and make an estimate of how much of that visitor spending can we attribute to the cultural heritage facilities that they're visiting. Sure, they come to town, they may come for a football game, but they might go to the museum too. Let's not count the football game side. That's a good thing, too, but that's not what we're here for. So we're not taking all the credit for every visitor here, but quite a bit of it here. And again, that creates a bunch of jobs, has multiplier effects as well, as you can see highlighted on the right-hand side. And then that points out, some again, the leverage factor, this, the economic return for a $2.8 million that you saw on the previous in direct spending. That's the spending of those four heritage facilities we were talking about, activities we were talking about. You get another $8.89 million just from that in economic activity here in the region, here in the city, and then multipliers for earnings as well, so that becomes, contributes to the earnings of households, people who work and live here in Columbia, and then 50 jobs on an annual basis are supported through that, and then 120 jobs overall, as it turns out, on the multiplier effect. Well, continuing on with the third leg of what the study was, again, based as a basis was that previous Missouri study. Well, could we repeat it here in Columbia? Let's look at the main streets, and that's one of the things that this previous study. Well, the main street, at least the easiest one to study, is downtown here in Columbia. There may be others, by the way, and it may be worth studying as time goes on to see how we might focus on those. This isn't necessarily historic preservation numbers here. A lot of it is, as you saw on that previous map. Most of the historic preservation properties that had gone through the tax credit program are downtown or in the district. And but what we noticed here is we went and looked at the data. What is it? Is downtown as a whole contributing to this excitement? And if you start looking, if you look at the growth in the value of property values in the downtown area here, it has kind of a steady state until about 2004-ish, and that's about the time the historic tax credit program started to take off in the city. And with that, among other factors, but certainly we like to take all the credit because of the tax credits and the investments in the historic buildings downtown here, that the values downtown took off in all categories, not just the historic buildings, but all of them on average. And you can see how that growth has helped a lot, probably helped a lot to get through some of the recession in terms of the value created. Value created then, you can see on the next graphic, we took that sample of the downtown buildings and compared it to the property value sample, property value growth over the same 10 years in other downtown buildings. Comparing on the left there, the downtown historic buildings, other downtown buildings, a sample of suburban buildings and a sample of buildings out in Boone County. And clearly the growth in the value of the buildings is where we invested historic tax credits. So we saw growth in the value of downtown properties. The bulk of that's coming out of the buildings we've invested in from a historic basis. That probably is translating also the value in the other properties that are downtown or will over time, as those things catch on and people start making investments in non-historic properties, but nevertheless buildings that contribute to the character of the downtown. Clearly, we should be investing in historic preservation, and we should be doing that downtown. We get great values here. That's lessons learned here and what's going on. And this then takes all of that and translates to what's been the growth in the tax revenues that have come off of those same categories. Clearly, downtown has contributed a lot. Boone County, buildings in Boone County, they got a lot of value growing out there. So you see a relatively slower value increase, but there's a powerful force going on with regard to tax base. But downtown, where that investment's being made, looks like things are doing quite well and contributes to the tax base as well. And let me conclude then with a sustainability issue. As this points out here, 26 demolitions here in the city per year of historic properties of scale, 1,500 square feet or some other things. We're not looking at smaller buildings. It's looking at historic preservation from another angle and saying, if we don't do this, we gain. By tearing those things down, we actually create a lot of debris. We fill up landfills. We cause a lot of other environmental questions that cost money. You can actually quantify some of this, $94,000 a year put in the landfills. If we could preserve those buildings, reinvest in them, we eliminate this cost, environmental and dollar costs, and we also increase probably the value of those properties and the value that they contribute to the communities. So this was an attempt to get an early metric on not only looking at the positive growth, but what happens if you could eliminate some of the negative issues regarding historic preservation. I don't know if we had 20 minutes from that.
Yeah, perfect.
Not bad.
Let me ask you a couple questions that probably have answers that are unknowable, but I'll give it a shot anyway. Of the 20% of investment historic preservation that was related to tax credits.
The pie chart you're talking about,
yeah,
going back to?
Yeah, in other words, there's a lot of investment that's not related to tax credit.
Right.
20% are. Is it knowable how many of those would have happened in the absence of tax credits? Probably not knowable, is it?
My experience with, and I don't know that they would know any better, I'm looking back at Rachel or to Kyle. Kyle's my partner here. I don't think they would know either. My experience is not at that scale, no. The historic tax credits that Missouri instituted, in combination with the federal tax credits, do a lot to encourage the renovation, rehab, and reuse of the historic buildings. Now, that said, if you had a booming economy, very few places do. We aren't Las Vegas. Well, Las Vegas fell apart, too, but or Washington, D.C., you could probably get by without it because we need those buildings to occupy activity. St. Louis, Kansas City, Springfield have used the program, and it's been a great boon to save those buildings and reoccupy them. It means we don't have to build new buildings either, but I don't know that it's knowable right now.
The second question that probably also has an unknowable answer. A lot of political rhetoric about state tax credits. Do we have any sense of where that's going? Are these going to dry up? Are they going to continue? All I know is there's noise out there, and I don't know where that noise is directing us.
Interestingly, we just had the Missouri Main Street Conference in St. Louis 2 weeks ago, and I was lucky enough to get elected to the board. So there's a lot of that chatter going on about that. Kind of nobody knows. The general scuttlebutt is that the given numbers like this, and these numbers prove out statewide in other cities, that it's not wise to give up on that program. Should there be modifications? I'm not real sure. But it's been a valuable program in investing in our heritage of the state. And it returns some things, it reoccupies spaces. So there is some value there. That said, it's all those things are on the block. This one, this particular tax credit program, has proved itself. So you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and some of that bathwater needs to go, frankly. But we don't know. Right now, scuttlebutt is, yeah, it's good. The very powerful forces behind it, in terms of the developers and the folks that are involved with it in historic preservations. But is that enough to overcome throwing it out? And would things be different, a lot different, if we didn't have it? Nobody really knows right now. Yeah.
Other comments, questions from council?
I just have a one comment that might be an answer to your question is Arne Fagan and who did the one on Oakland Gravel was at the Guitar Mansion. Both of those people said they were really glad they did it and they're never going to do it again. And I imagine that the requirements of qualifying for the tax credits are sufficient, that the tax credits are needed if you want to do it that way.
Thank you.
I have a question. The 117% rise in downtown historic, are those just properties that were rehabbed through tax credit programs?
Yeah. For that bar graph, yes. So we looked at downtown as a whole, but we isolated those out. Yeah. So we invested in them. They create a lot of value, and that created a lot of tax base out of them, which, frankly, given that graph, hasn't yet shown up in many of the other downtown buildings. Hopefully that'll come as reinvestment occurs or as the economy improves. People see the value of having a historic building here. That's doing well. I'll renovate mine. And the district people have talked about that, more investment in the public realm and so forth. The downtown charrette you talked about that Brent raised is all part of that process as well. Let's improve the whole character, bring the value of everything up a little higher.
What is your definition of what makes a historic building historic?
You know, I lose track of that. Rachel, do you know the definition of what's a historic building historic in these circumstances? It changed from place to place.
Well, Well, it's a little bit subjective, but the very basic rule is that it has to be at least 50 years old. And then beyond that, it has to have significant architectural characteristics and then also cultural characteristics. So perhaps you had a famous person who lived there, grew up there, worked there, that sort of thing. So we look for both significant architecture and then also the cultural legacy. But 50 years is the absolute bare minimum.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm presuming some commission, does our Historic Preservation Commission make that determination, or does the federal board, or does the IRS in the case of the tax credits?
Well, to qualify for a historic preservation state tax credit, you either have to be on the National Register, which is typically the first step, or there's a couple other processes by which you can qualify, but usually National Register is going to be the first step. And that's a full application nomination process that's cleared first by the State Historic Preservation Office and then the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
Mm-hmm. So how do you separate the emotional engagement of a neighborhood versus the practicality of raising a house?
I don't know if I have a
well, presumably the whatever
on the demolitions. Yeah. How do you separate the emotional neighborhood of the emotion engagement of the neighbors versus what's practical?
Well, a lot of people do get, of course, very excited or very attached to their older homes, but just because something is an older home or an older building does not necessarily make it historically significant. So by being on the National Register, for instance, or even being locally recognized as most notable, there's a certain vetting process to ensure that some of those architectural and cultural characteristics are being met.
All right. Put words in your mouth a little bit. The 144 we've got in here are those that have been vetted through the city and the Preservation Commission. There are probably a lot more buildings here and houses in particular that are more than 50 years old. But the 144 sort of match what the city would like to see.
So the analogy I want to draw is what made the homes on St. Joseph Street historical and the house on 113 North Yarth was not historical? Nobody said a word about it.
I don't know if I know where St. Joseph Street
it's
is.
Gone.
I don't think these consultants are familiar with the local demolitions.
I'm
right
asking
now.
You.
Oh, wait, okay. Great.
Yeah.
It's a great question. I think those kind of issues should continue to come up.
It's a matter of emotion, in my opinion.
Oh, in many ways. That's correct. Yeah. But that's frankly, that's why I think there are political leaders to help make those decisions. Although we can certainly advise on the technical side as well as the planning department. Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you very much on a very compelling presentation.
Thanks. We look forward to any comments you have, and we'll get the final report out.
Right. Thank you very much.
On a somewhat related note, we have completed a greenhouse gas emissions inventory update, and Barbara Buffalo is here to present that.
Well, not really. She's here to pass it off. I'm like Rachel. No, I'm just kidding. We partnered this summer with the University of Missouri's Environmental Assistance Center and their pollution prevention program, their internship program that they have, which is awesome and fantastic and one of my favorite things to do. And we were awarded with James Mitchell from the University of Missouri Kansas City campus, who moved to Columbia for the summer because he heard it was great and he heard he got to work with me. So James has been working on the greenhouse gas emissions inventory update, and I'm actually going to have James present. I'll bring up your presentation.
Hi, and good evening. Like Barbara said, my name is James Mitchell. I moved here to work with Barbara as her sustainability intern. And like she said, I moved here to Columbia just for this internship. So first, I would like to say really what a beautiful city you have and what wonderful people live here. And I'd like to thank you for sustaining such an open and hospitable town. I've really enjoyed it. Tonight, I'll be presenting the 2010 Greenhouse Gas Emissions Inventory of the City of Columbia.
It might be over here. Hold on.
I'll just tell you when to pass it off, I guess.
Yeah, you can just tell me when to advance.
Next. Okay, so let's start with some background. In 2006, City Council passed the Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement. Now, by passing this agreement, City Council agreed to support the Kyoto Protocol. What this means is that by passing it, City Council said they were going to strive to reduce emissions by 7% compared to 1990 baseline levels. Now, Colombia's first step in support of Kyoto was the completion of 2000 and 2005 greenhouse gas emissions inventories. This was done in 2007. Next. All right, so project scope. I'm going to start at the bottom of the screen here. This project includes really four objectives. So first I'm going to explain what's at the bottom. It's ICLEI. So ICLEI stands for the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. This organization publishes protocols, or just basically guidelines, to help communities such as our own complete thorough, accurate, and repeatable greenhouse gas emissions inventories. So they help us really provide structure to our reports. All of the figures tonight are going to be in metric tons, carbon dioxide equivalent, and this is, you see the abbreviation at the bottom of the screen, that's MTCO2E. So the community inventory includes greenhouse gas emissions from the city of Colombia and also the emissions that Colombia is responsible for. So if you flip on a light here, some of that power is not going to be produced in Colombia, but you're still responsible for that emission. Next, to standardize the community inventories. The protocols are constantly improving for doing community inventories. So the 2000 and 2005 inventories needed some updating. I completed that, and you'll see that whenever a value has been standardized, there'll be an asterisk by it, and it'll be noted at the bottom. Next, the Colombia City Government Inventory. So it could potentially be very good in helping Colombia City Government find some savings, control costs. It represents the energy use, so that's natural gas, electricity, and it also represents the waste and the fuel use by the city government. Lastly, recommendations based on findings. So it represents a lot of work to find all this information for these inventories. So having found this data, you know, talked to the people that have it, put it together, analyzed it, and then compared it with other cities, you know, surely I could come up with something. So I've got a few things for you tonight. All right, so I don't want to make you wait for the conclusion here. In 2010, Colombia emitted 2,272,093 metric tons carbon dioxide equivalent. Now, before I compare this with previous years or with other cities, I'd like to break this down and explain exactly what each sector includes and what it means. So we'll begin with transportation emissions. In 2010, transportation was responsible for a little over a quarter of Colombia's emissions. Transportation emissions represent really the miles driven in Colombia annually. You see here that from 2005 to 2010, there's a somewhat more dramatic increase. And when I compared this with population increase, I found that population alone couldn't account for this. So if you click one more time, you'll see that in 2010, Colombians have actually driven more than in previous years. So this attributes to more of an increase in transportation emissions. If there aren't any questions, I'll move on to waste.
I will point out that's a 20% increase. The population in that census cycle did increase by 28%. So I don't know if it's accurate or not. It would imply that we actually per capita are producing less CO2 emissions over those 10 years.
Okay, so I guess my data came from the 2010 census and the 2005 projection. I have this Excel, it's very transparent. As far as I know, I've calculated each of these three values in the same way. I've divided them by the population. Can I ask what population you're using for 2005?
I thought you were using 2000 and 2010 numbers. Are you using 2005 and 2010 numbers?
All three. Each one's calculated.
I'm comparing 2000 to 2010.
Right.
Columbia went from 84,000 to 108,000, which is a 28% increase.
Yes.
And the transportation emissions, if you divide 589 by 487, that's a 20% increase. So by those numbers, we actually, per capita-wise, are not producing more individually. Now, maybe we should be doing a lot better.
Actually, isn't the graph on the left saying that 5% of that 25% is...
We're driving more per person.
And yeah. The 15% would be about the population increase.
Okay. So we are driving more. I see that graph. Go ahead.
Okay, great. If there aren't anything else, I'll go on. Thanks. So waste emissions. Waste emissions represent those emissions from our sanitary landfill and also from our wastewater treatment. All in all, they encompass about 1.5% of our total aggregate emissions, and I'd like to kind of explain the asterisks at the bottom first. The graph actually represents calculations based with the old ICLEI method. So ICLEI does have a more up-to-date method. However, there just simply was not enough information to recalculate 2000-2005. So I just want to make this clear for completeness that in the graph here, and then also in aggregate emissions, we're going to use the old calculation method so that all of the inventories are directly comparable to one another.
And this looks like it's 10%, which is less than the population increase.
Right. So from,
And it looks like it's flat since 2005. Is that because we're capturing gas, or are we recycling more? Or are you going to get to that?
I'll get to that, yeah. So I'll start with waste. Water emissions. So wastewater emissions go up incrementally, essentially with just with population growth. However, we see that solid waste increases from 2000 to 2005 and increases with population. However, then we see from 2005 to 2010 that it does not increase with population. This is because there was a change in the waste stream. The Missouri Department of Natural Resources conducts waste composition studies every 10 years or so. So in 2008, when this waste composition study came out, showed that there was about 5% total less paper in our waste. Paper is high in carbon content, and it's inorganic. So when it decomposes, it releases methane, which is a greenhouse gas and which is counted in this inventory. So I think if that answers your question, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wonder, like, if we're producing it, but we capture it and we use it, are we netting it out, or are you netting it out?
Right. So that if we catch it, and the way that these are calculated, there's a lot of rules in exactly how to do this. And essentially, if you capture it and you flare it, so that's you just burn it off, or if you capture it and you create energy with it, it's counted the same in emissions. And this is just because right now there just aren't good ways to calculate this. Because the equipment that this is done with varies so widely, this is just the recommended practice. Again, you know, it's not ideal, but this is just the protocol. Okay, so moving down to energy emissions, as you can see here, are comprised mostly of electricity. So this is electricity production and also natural gas consumption. All in all, energy emissions encompass nearly three-quarters of Columbia's emissions. I would like to focus slightly more on electricity just because of the size of the emissions. So if we can click once more. This is just to represent Columbia's three utilities. So we have water and light, University of Missouri, and then Boone Electric. So in blue, you see percent of electricity provided. So this is just percent provided to the entire city. And then in the red, you see percent of electricity emissions. So this is meant to show that utilities' emissions can vary. And what variations are caused by is where we buy our power and how that power is produced. And to illustrate this, if we can click once more, here are all of the utilities, this is each of the three utilities, non-renewable suppliers. So here we have, this is pounds of CO2e per megawatt hour. So this is basically for the same amount, one unit of energy, This is the amount of carbon pollution that we get, or carbon dioxide equivalent pollution we can get. And this isn't meant to call anyone out by any means. It's just meant to show you that it really matters where power comes from. It can really make a difference in a town's pollution. So we can go on from here. Okay, so we have actually some rather surprising results. I did not expect this. We see, again, at the bottom in blue, natural gas increases steadily with population. We see from 2000 to 2005, we have an increase in electricity emissions. And this is just an increase in usage. It just goes along with population growth. However, then we see in 2005 to 2010 a rather surprising drop. And these are all calculated with the same method. But what happened is where we bought our energy, it changed. So we were buying less from plants such as Nearman and Sykeston. These are coal-fired power plants. And they have a very high emissions ratio, or emissions coefficient. And with this, if there are any questions, I can move on to aggregate, which puts it all together and compares it. Okay, so the results are that Columbia's emissions have increased by 4.6% rather than decreasing by 7%, as was the Kyoto goal. And to be fair, the target is a 2012 target, but it's reasonable to assume that Columbia will not reach that target. And to put it another way, if we can click once more, here's how Columbia stands regionally and nationally. So within the state, we are better than St. Louis and Kansas City. This is per capita. However, regionally, we are certainly behind in emissions. And nationally, we emit more than the average American.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Absolutely. I have all of these numbers very transparently in Excel. Anyone can have these files.
Well, you know, I guess I'm struggling with the population increase because if you take that 2171 and multiply it times 1.28, matching it per capita would give you 2.778 million tons of CO2 equivalents. So we are actually are about 2272 is a good 15% below that. So I just in dealing with your methods, I could be wrong here, but it looks like we're not calculating the population increase.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Are you calculating from 2005 or from the 2000?
No, 2010.
Okay, so explain once more. I kind of lost you. Do you understand?
It might be one of the things. So the per capita, if we go to the next one for the per capita, are you saying the 20.9
is not? If you go back to the previous slide, there's a 28% increase in emissions from 2010 is what you would expect with a 28% increase in population.
Yeah. Right. I think.
Okay. And that would be 2.7.
I think what he's trying to say is that we're actually declining.
Right, and so this is where I'm going to say,
per capita.
That's awesome. Yes, right. Awesome per capita. Unfortunately, that's not what the challenge was.
Yeah.
At the time when the Kyoto Protocol came out, it understood the population. We got into this long discussion earlier, like, well, what are we going to do, Barbara, like limit people growing? And I'm obviously violating that ordinance. But it was the discussion of if we want to maintain the same quality of life, you want to reduce emissions down so that you can maintain that rather than as we continue to have growth for them to keep getting worse. So the challenge was for communities to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions without limiting their growth or without limiting their economy. And so that's what this is. So
I believe that's impossible.
Well, and yeah, and that's what
you have to go down to 15,000 college students to get there.
Well, that's what we said. We're like, well, if we rate increase, double rates, yeah, we've just limited our population because everybody's moved out of the city. So it's more of that we understand the realistic challenge with this, and I think that's one of the recommendations that James is going to have is what do we want the goals to be? You know, and that's what council's going to have to think about. 7% is obviously maybe if we had thought about this a long time ago and started purchasing from better sources at the time, we could have been meeting this easily, if not the 7%, something better.
Well, that would be basically a 35% per capita decrease. I don't understand the methodology of not using a per capita.
Oh, I'm just.
So again, that was just the mayor's climate protection agreement, which city council passed in 2006. The purpose of this project was to just go along with that agreement and calculate it under those rules.
I see.
Yeah. So the per capita in 2005, it's about 25 to 26 metric tons per person. I think if you calculated it out. So yeah, we certainly have had a.
Oh, sorry.
Go back. Yeah.
I was trying to get
we that. Certainly have had a decrease in per capita emissions, mostly due to changes in where we buy our energy.
Are you including the emissions that are created when you're buying the energy? I mean, if we're buying it from Iowa from their wind generators, you've still got stuff that is, you're still using, getting emissions wherever you're buying it from.
Yeah. So the way emissions are calculated, all emissions coefficients are taken from the same source. That's EPA eGrid 2012. It's just a large database of every power generation facility in the U.S. They have EPA calculated emissions coefficients. So what I've done, I've gotten power purchase information from each of our three utilities. And from Water and Light, I also have power sale. So let's say we buy 100,000 units, we sell 10,000. I'll use 90,000 in the calculation. So the calculation is simply power use times your emissions coefficient. Times your grid loss, and then you have your answer of your individual emissions. Does that answer your question sufficiently?
And one quick thing, too, Mayor, to go back with you. When looking at cities that have signed the Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, very small handful have met their goal for what they're doing. Most of them pride themselves on what they are doing to try to reduce. So, for instance, Austin is looking. When you looked at theirs, they're looking to actually to meet theirs, James. And what are they doing to meet theirs?
Austin is essentially somewhat buying their way out of it. So they're purchasing a lot of green tags, or renewable energy certificates, to offset what they're actually emitting.
I guess that we've had a lot of initiatives, which I think have been very successful. And I'm interpreting this data this way: we are using 84% per capita. Of CO2, we're producing 84% per capita of the CO2 equivalents now than we did in 2000. And I think that's a spectacular response to the renewable energy program, to the changes in purchasing. So for me, given the explosive growth of Columbia, I'm very impressed with what the city has done in the previous 12 years.
Okay, well, if there aren't any questions here, we can move on.
What percent of power is purchased from Sykeston?
I don't have that with me. I certainly have that.
And Ted knows.
I would guess it's probably about
3 or 4 slides back. Had Sykeston on it. Sykeston and Columbia. Can we go back to that?
Sure. Yeah, just the red bars. Back 2 more, I think. Here we are. Yes. And again, this isn't actual emissions. This is just emissions coefficients. So for one unit of energy, this is how much these certain plants emit.
Okay. Are they burning that much cleaner coal than we are? Is that what that means?
It has to do, this is EPA calculated. So it has to do with inputs. So energy inputs, how efficient the furnaces are.
And we have an old plant.
And while this number is high on ours, as far as when Columbia Power Plant actually operates, it's a very small point of our time. We very rarely.
Right. Now, you said that like 40% of the emissions is from transportation.
I think it's actually just over 1/4 of emissions.
1/4?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So if we continue to develop a robust transit system, then that will help reduce the emissions.
Will help reduce transport emissions?
Right.
Is that what you're saying? We'll certainly address that in recommendation 3. It's more of a long-term
In fact, I'm wondering if that's why Chicago is so much lower than the other cities in your sample. I wonder if you put in New York City or Boston, Philadelphia, if you get similar.
So transportation has a lot to do with it, but again, energy for Americans is a huge source of emissions. So Chicago offsets some of their emissions. They also, I think, buy some from nuclear as well. It has a lot to do with density, I think.
I think you have some recommendations. We probably better get to those.
Okay, recommendations. So going straight on from here, the city government inventory is incomplete because it was impossible. Quite honestly, the city's internal information systems, the way they're designed, they're just, again, they're just old systems. You can't find utility use by department. Utility use by department is collected by different people. It's very, very hard to find this information. Now, a city like Austin, Austin, Texas, has set a tremendous municipal greenhouse gas reduction goal. So this is city government reductions. Their goal is 100% by 2020. The first way they're doing this is with serious emissions reductions. So they're going to be more efficient. They're doing this with technology, and they're also doing this with behavioral improvements. And to assess how they're doing in real time, they have this information available to them, and they can see what's working, what's not, and they can hold, if a department is doing poorly or doing well, they can commend or hold someone accountable for what's happening. And they're looking at saving a tremendous amount of money with the efficiency program. Okay, recommendation two. So recommendation two is to recommit to serious emission reductions, short and long term, and integrate them. Now I'm going to break this down into three sections here. First, recommit to serious emissions reductions. The reason I say this is because one of my first assignments whenever I came to Columbia was to familiarize myself with initiatives, see what was happening. I saw that Columbia signed on to the Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, and I saw that it referenced Kyoto. I knew that Kyoto meant 7% by 2012, so I went looking for that number, and I found that it couldn't be found in any city literature. I read every environment and every energy document that I could find on the website, and it ended up the only place that I found this number was in the City Council minutes from July 17th, 2006. Next is short and long term. So in the short term and in the long term, the ways that Columbia can reduce its emissions are quite different. Short term will be addressed in recommendation three, and long term will also be addressed there. And then integrate them. What I mean by integrate them is integrating efficiency throughout government. And this is going to be accomplished better by first completing a successful government inventory, and also finding ways to become more efficient and to save more money. All right, so recommendation three. So recommendation three, increase renewable energy purchases and expand energy efficiency, retrofit, and demand-side management programs. Now, I recommend this because it's the only way that Columbia can truly reduce its emissions in the short term, if that is a priority for Columbia. If we can go to the first, yeah, there we go. So this is a slightly different look at Columbia's emissions. So I'm not doing this to call Water and Light out. They've actually done a very commendable job at meeting and exceeding the renewable energy standard of Columbia. Right now, they're above 10% renewables, which is, again, commendable. I'm doing this to actually show an opportunity. So if Columbia is serious about cutting its emissions in the short term, energy policy is really the only answer that we have. The reason I say that, waste, of course, there's good waste management practices here, but it's a very small percentage. Transportation, the transportation emissions are, I estimate, going to continue to go up. The 2010 transportation numbers are an increase from 2005, yet they do represent mass transit, and they do represent the non-transportation grant that Columbia received. So unfortunately, just because of the culture, these transportation emissions are very hard to control. This is something that will have to be addressed in the long term. Probably, and honestly, this is a very practical look. It will have to be addressed with more investment in public transport and a more serious look at changing the culture around the use of a car, because that's where our emissions are coming from. And so if we can go to the last graphic here. There are many ways. I've left Columbia with some tools, some Excel-based tools, that Columbia could hypothetically reach its 7% reduction goal by 2015. So assuming a 10% increase in transportation emissions, which is reasonable, and a 5% increase in energy use by 2015, if Columbia were to go to 30% renewable, replacing its dirtiest sources, so if you just divide this out, it won't quite work. But if you have all the source data and you replace your most carbon-intensive energy, this is essentially the only way to do it by 2015. Again, this I've given you this because it is the only practical approach that I could find. It's the only way I could figure out for Columbia to actually get down to this number. And with that, that concludes the update of the 2010 emissions inventory. Questions?
Very good presentation. Questions from council? I think for me, again, I respectfully think that we're doing, I mean, this was done before I became mayor. I'm not taking any credit for it, but between 2000 and 2010, I'm seeing a 16% per capita reduction in CO2 emissions from the previous administration population, and I think that's a trend that we should anticipate, hope to continue, or in fact accelerate through the demand side management programs you run, through the renewable energy program that we've had since 2004, and as Ms. Hoppe talked about, an increased focus on transit. So I think there are opportunities that lie out there for us to continue the slope of this graph downward. Columbia is going to continue to grow. There's 93 million more people in this world every year, and 3,000 of them are going to choose to live in Columbia. And so we'll have to continue to address this in the way we have over the last 10 years, and I think we've seen evidence of success.
Can we get this emailed to us?
Oh, yeah. You'll get this as well as the report that goes along with it describing where the numbers. And also make it available for the website.
Thank you very much for your work.
Thank you so much.
Very good. Very good presentation, Ms. Mitchell. Let's take a 5-minute break and try to start as promptly as we can at 7.